Are you a Catholic woman who loves your faith, but finds certain aspects of living it out challenging and confusing? Are you a Catholic wife striving for a healthy, holy marriage and sex life, but don't know where to turn for straightforward, faithful, nitty-gritty answers to some of your deep and delicate questions? Are you a Catholic mom who's tired of the compare and despair game we all fall victim to on social media, and are just in need of some solidarity as you discover your own unique motherhood? Are you tired of the sunshine and rainbows pitch? Want to lean into the both and of the mess that happens when the truths of our faith get lived in a fallen world? Well, if that's where you find yourself, you're in the right place. Hi, I'm Emily Frazee, your host of the Total Wine Podcast. I'm here to dig deep and tackle topics that we are all curious about, but maybe too afraid to ask. I'll answer it all with honesty and humor, because living the faithful life can make you either laugh or cry, and well, laughing burns more calories. Welcome to the show. Welcome back to another episode of the Total Wine Podcast. I am here with a separate intro today. As you saw from the title description, there's another human being that I'm talking to. It's not me just talking, shouting at my computer screen. And I'm so excited to bring this conversation to you today. I'm thrilled. This is one of my good friends, Father Andrew Clark, of the Diocese of Arlington, Virginia. And he and I were friends before he became a priest, which, you know, just kind of adds a fun, unique layer to the conversation that we're having today. I'm not just talking to a priest. I'm talking to somebody that I knew before he was a priest. And we had some fun in the good old days. We share a little bit more about how we met and how we know each other in the episode, but I just had to share this one story because I didn't get to share this, that as you probably know, if you follow me on Instagram or whatnot, I talk about how I love scotch. Like that is my drink. If I am just going to have hard liquor, just pour me scotch neat. I'm a happy girl. And this goes way back to roughly about the time that I actually met Father Clark, before he was Father Clark. And for our wedding, he was so sweet. He got both my husband and I separate wedding gifts. And to my husband, he gave a very, very nice wristwatch. And to me, he gave a bottle of scotch. And 3 months after our wedding, I was pregnant with our first child, and I had not managed to finish this bottle of scotch in that time. I was like, I'm going to savor this because it's a nice bottle of scotch. Certainly not one that I buy myself on the regular. And I looked at my husband and I said, this was my wedding present. You got a separate wedding present. If you touch this before I have this child, you will die. He did not touch a drop for the remainder of the pregnancy, but that is Father Clark. We had such good times before he went off to the seminary, and we continue to have good times whenever we do manage to see each other and have fun. But today, I'm just this, the conversation on discernment. I saw his face pop up on my Instagram feed when I opened the app up one day. Our diocese published a clip of a video of him talking about discernment. And he talked about discernment in a way that I had never heard it talked about before. And I instantly knew. I was like, oh, he's got to come on the podcast. We have got to talk about this. And specifically, I want to talk about this within the context of NFP, because obviously this comes up so much in the context of talking about family planning, whether to avoid and whether to achieve, and like, can you use it selfishly? And then it always comes back to, well, it's about the couple's discernment. And this is something that I've talked about frequently, that I hear echoed all over the place, is that we don't understand what discernment is. There's such poor catechesis about what discernment is. And as soon as I saw that video, I was like, yes, okay, we are going to talk. And so I shot him a text with the video link, and I was like, you want to come on my podcast? And he laughed, and he was like, sure. And I know Father Clark well enough to know that probably should not coordinate plans via text if we're going to have them happen. So I knew I was going to see him the following weekend that I saw the video. And yeah, so I just, I ambushed him at a brunch with friends and got him on the calendar, and now I get to bring this episode. And as I said, I'm beyond thrilled to be able to share what he shared with me in this episode. We've had a lot of conversations over our friendship. There were times where, we'd get into heated debates. If you know Father Clark, he went to Christendom. He was on the debate team, so like he can get into it. He's like a sanguine extrovert, just like me. So it's entertaining, I guess, to watch us kind of go at it because we both get very passionate about whatever we believe. But today we're coming together very much in agreement. And one thing that just struck me in the conversation that we had was just it's been so amazing to watch him go from, just this guy I knew, it's kind of like meeting a golden retriever, and then to watch him step into his vocation, to step into this yes to God, and to see the transformation, just an incredibly beautiful transformation. He hasn't changed per se, but he's become, like, it's just very visible. He's become who God has made him to be. Like, this is who he was made to be. And I think that ultimately, like, that's the reason why we discern, right? Is that we are trying to do the will of God, and that we are trying to figure out what it is we are called to say yes to. And then we're supposed to say that yes and step forward into it. And I've seen Father Clark do that. And the fruit of his yes is already coming in. And you will see that, you will hear that, and you will feel that, I hope, in this conversation. And the final thing that I just want to throw out there, because, this is one of my passions, and I say this with caveats, but I firmly believe that it is so important for lay people to know their priests. If you're a married couple, whether you have kids, don't have kids, like, this is kind of my mantra when it comes to this, is have your priest over for dinner. And the reason why I always say have your priest over for dinner is because, food is a great equalizer. Everybody's got to eat. And so it's a great way to invite somebody into your home to have something to do, but also having something to share, something that you instantly have in common. We're all sitting down eating the same meal. It's just a kind of a great icebreaker per se. And I know this isn't doable for everybody, and I've had people come back and tell me they have invited their priest, but he says no. And yeah, that's not great. But if you are in a position where you can extend the invitation, do it. I had another priest friend tell me that, the sacraments of holy orders and the sacrament of matrimony are complementary sacraments of service. We are meant to enrich each other's vocations. We need each other. We need the witness of each other's vocations. And we can't get that purely in the span of an hour on Sunday. And we can't get that in, like, what, the 5, 10 minutes, maybe 15 if you've been real bad in the confessional. There needs to be space for encounter. And I know that we have a lot of problems in our church today. And so I just want to encourage you, as you listen to our conversation, yes, we were friends before he became a priest. So there is obviously more of a camaraderie, more of a comfort. But you can have conversations like this with your priest too. And as you listen, I want to remind you that priests are human beings. And yes, they are ordained, their hands are consecrated, their words absolve us of our sins, their words take bread and wine and transubstantiate it into the body and blood of Christ, right? This is powerful, powerful stuff. They are set apart. And at the same time, they're shepherds. And shepherds need to reek of their sheep. And sometimes that means that the sheep need to extend an invitation. So if you've been waiting for the nudge, let this be the nudge. If you're not in a position where you can do it, that's totally fine. But I just encourage you in everything throughout our conversation, like, yes, get, like, everything that you can out of the discernment discussion. And also, think about having your priest over for dinner. So enjoy our conversation. I can't wait for you to listen. Hi, Father Clark. Thanks for joining me today.
Absolutely. Yeah, happy to. Happy to. It's easy for two extroverts to find a reason to talk to each other.
I know. What's not going to be easy is for two extroverts to limit this to an hour, but that's where my
That's
kids are
right.
going to be like, all right, here's how this is going to go. Okay, so for everybody who is having an aneurysm right now, because they follow me and they know you, we have to start by telling everybody how we know each
Sure. Yeah, it's funny.
other.
So I think it's so, yeah, it's a good story too. So, I mean, so we first met. Probably actually it would have been 10 years ago.
Dang,
It
has
would
it
have been
been
10
10
years
years?
ago. Yeah, it would have been 10 years ago. It'd
Oh.
be either this month or next month. In fact, I think it was 10 years ago this month, because it would have been this it was been right before I started my senior year at Christendom. And that was the summer that our mutual friends, the Robertses, or Chris specifically, moved into the house where
Yep.
your then boyfriend, now husband, was living. So, we first met when I came over to visit him specifically. I came over to see the new digs and see the house and everything. And then we were in that front room in the old house. And then you and Nick came in, and that was where we first like shook hands essentially. But and then it was only about a year and a half later that I moved into the house when
You were moving
you
in.
and Nick were engaged, right? And you guys were engaged at that point. So
Nice.
your husband and I shared a room for about
Before
three or
we were
four months.
married, you
Right. That's right. That's right. Well, it's
you
like
shared a room with my husband before I did.
before you did. That's exactly right. And it's like it's funny that I'm just reminded of my older brother married a woman who before he ever met her, I was her partner in a wedding. I was the groomsman and she was the bridesmaid
And we were all trying to set
and
y'all
we
up.
were
We
right. Oh,
were
totally.
all like, can
It's
we be your wingman, Clark? Come on, let's go.
like, no, I have to go to seminary.
Yep.
And now she's married to my older brother. So it's just like that's another really fun
Hilarious.
small Catholic world.
Hilarious.
Yeah, so basically, and it was I would say that was when we really became friends, right? Was when
Yep.
like I was living with Nick, and then you were over at least once a week on Sundays for brunch and things like that. And then I was an usher at your guys' wedding.
Yep, and I do have a little dirt on you for that one. You were supposed to be in charge of the beer, and I remember we told you to leave like right after we said the vows. We were like, you can stay for that part, but then you got to go because you got to pick up the beer and get it to the venue. And y'all were taking Nick's truck, and I have video evidence that y'all didn't leave until after we did like our first kiss.
Yeah, well,
You
these things are
had
important.
to stick
These
around
things
for
are important. These
the
things are
good stuff.
important. Things are important, and you have to stick around for them.
I did. And the beer got to the
The
wedding, so that's all that
beer
mattered.
got to the wedding.
The
Everything
beer
was
got to the
okay.
wedding.
See?
Everything was
Everything
fine.
was okay. I
And I
tell
was
my I
none the wiser in the moment. So like I
this is
didn't get
right.
in the
This is
yep.
right. And it's really funny. Whenever I do rehearsals now as a priest, I'm always telling brides, something's gonna go wrong, but it's gonna be fine. Tomorrow's gonna be great. Just so you know, if something's gonna go wrong and I don't want you to worry about it. When you see it go wrong, remember that what I said to you right now. It's fine. Don't worry about it. And
Here's
like
something else you can
it's
tell
funny.
them. The only hitch that needs to go off is you saying your vows.
Right.
That's the only
Right.
hitch. Like,
Exactly.
it, like, if that
Everything
is the
else can go
only thing
wrong.
that happens tomorrow, it was a good day.
It was a good
That's
day.
it.
Right.
That's
Right.
it. Yeah.
Nope. Yeah, totally true. Totally true. And I love doing weddings as a priest. I really, really love it. It's really, really
Yeah.
cool. It's a ton of fun.
How many have you done so far? I mean,
Oh, I've
you
only
just got
done
ordained like 2 months ago.
Yeah, I've only done I guess I've only done four. But I was doing rehearsals as a deacon because when my
Ah,
pastor
okay.
at my deacon assignment, yeah, when my pastor at my deacon assignment found out that I had been a groomsman 12 times, he was like, "You've been a groomsman 12 times." Yeah,
You
yes,
know the
Father.
inner workings, man.
He
Get up
said,
there.
yep, no, he said, "You're doing all the wedding rehearsals for the rest of the summer." That was last year. You're doing all the wedding rehearsals for the rest of the summer. It's your job.
Wow.
I was,
Nice.
thank you. Because like
You
as a deacon, it's your job to take things off the priest's plate so they have actual time to do other things. So
There you go. And use the
yeah.
gifts and talents that you have acquired.
Right. And I
I
enjoy it. Most priests do not enjoy doing wedding rehearsals. They're fine
can't
with it.
imagine why.
I know, right?
Yeah.
But I really love it. I think it's fun, because I'm a crazy extrovert. So,
Yes.
yeah,
The bridezilla, the mother of the bride, the mother-in-law, yeah, the mother of the groom, like, yeah, bring it all on, bring it all on. I can see that. I can 100% see that. I
I
am
enjoy
this
it.
much surprised.
Yeah,
None. Absolute
right,
zero.
right.
Yeah.
Yep, totally
Yeah.
true.
So we had good times at that house too. Such good
Oh,
times.
fantastic.
We have so many stories. But
Oh
really,
my
honestly, the
gosh.
person that we have the most dirt on is my darling Nicholas. So he should
Oh,
be
it's totally
very
true.
we
You
should
should
be
be
very
very,
worried that
yep, the two of us are talking
we are
publicly about
record
him.
not just talking, but recording a conversation. He's the one who should be worried. But
Absolutely.
yeah, oh, good times. Good times. So yeah, so the reason why I'm talking to you today is because you did this video for our diocese. And I just saw the clip, but I'm assuming it's part of like a bigger video, but about discernment. And the way that you define discernment, I was like, yes, we need to talk about this. Because like in the work that I do with NFP, this is something that comes up all the time. And really, I think it's the missing piece in the conversation about family planning. Because it's like, okay, there's the and the way that I define natural family planning is just it's fertility awareness plus discernment. Like you have the science, you have the reason, and then you have faith. And it's how you work those two things together. And so a lot of times there can be a lot of discussions where you kind of throw this baby out with the bathwater because, well, there could be selfish reasons for avoiding pregnancy. So therefore NFP is just bad. And it's like, well, no, there needs to be good discernment, good catechesis. So you defined discernment in a way that I was like, yes, okay, we need this. So let's start there. I want you to basically just say what you said in that video again. I hope you memorize it.
Yeah.
No, I'm joking.
No, sure.
Reword it. And yeah, so let's start there. Define
Sure, yeah.
discernment.
Yeah, I think that just before I do that, I think that it's really important that we demystify discernment. Because I think that people so often there was, and I didn't say this in the video, but one of the things that used to be said frequently in the church, I think it starts sometime in the middle of the 20th century. I don't think it's, I think it's a fairly modern phenomenon because it's not how the saints talk about it at all. But one of the things that you used to hear, right, and you still hear sometimes in some circles, you'll hear, well, you need to pray so you can figure out your vocation. And I think this is supremely unhelpful. And I think that it used to be the way that priests talked about discernment. You need to pray so you figure out who you're supposed to marry, so you figure out. And it was like, it was almost like the will of God was this thing he was kind of hiding from you, and you were supposed to go look for it like a detective and like search for clues. And when you found a clue, you were supposed to really kind of sit with it. And God being hidden is not the problem there. God, because the face of our Father is hidden in some sense in mystery. The problem is the idea that I'm supposed to figure this out, like it's some kind of thing that I have to go and like uncover, and then if I make mistakes, I have to backtrack, and it's like this very and it produced, and you can see this in the way that people discerned their vocations back in the 70s and 80s. Like if you ever, my mom will freely tell you, when my mom was trying to decide whether to marry my dad, she had this like huge, like months long anxiety about whether she was called to be a religious sister. And she even like left my dad for several months to go to Rome, like on pilgrimage to pray about whether or not she was supposed to be a nun, right?
Oh, wow.
And like, oh no, it was a whole thing. And she, because she was operating under this, I need to figure this out. And it just
Yeah.
caused tremendous anxiety, right? And when I look back on that, and of course she was only doing, and like she's not culpable in any way for that mistake because she was just doing what she thought was right
Yeah.
and what she had heard. And actually it ended up being a very fruitful time of prayer for her where she really deepened her relationship with God. But she, it was running into a very practical priest who is now a bishop in Australia. He was a Monsignor at the time. She ran into this Monsignor in Rome and she like told him her life story and she was like, nah, 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 nah. Going crazy.
Wait, are you telling me that your mom is an extrovert too?
Right. Shocker, shocker.
Shocker.
But basically he, this priest basically just kind of, he knew what discernment was and he kind of was able to reset her. And he just asked her like a super simple question. He just said, do you want to marry your boyfriend? And she was like, oh my gosh, Monsignor, yes. And he was like, "Do you want to be a nun?" And she's like, "I don't know." And he's like, "Okay, well, we have a clear indicator here of which direction you're supposed to go, you know?" And
Yes, yeah.
so that'll carry me, that'll be my bridge to defining discernment, because discernment is the discovery with God of my deepest desires. It's the discovery of my deepest desires. And my deepest desires are very often shrouded and covered over by my own sinfulness, by my own brokenness, and by the lies that I've believed about myself, or about the world, or about other people. And so one of the things that discernment is we're, when we're just, when we're seeking to know the will of God, we are actually praying and putting ourselves in the presence of God and praying for him to enlighten us as to what is the deepest desire that I have. Now that's kind of, and that's, it's so important, because one of the things I mentioned in the video that you talked about that kind of led us here is that there is this fear in so many people when they're praying about what the God wants them to do with their life. There's this fear that God's going to call them to do something that they really don't want to do, and then they're just going to be stuck with it their whole life. I'm going to be stuck doing this thing that I don't really want to do, which is totally incoherent, right? That's not how God works at all. He's not trying to trap you in some life that you're going to really hate. He wants to give you the deepest desires of your heart. So that's kind of the core of discernment, is discovering what is my deepest desire and then following God there to my deepest desire. And a lot of times guys have the experience of, they realize they have a deep desire to be a priest, or they have a deep desire to be a religious brother, or women have a desire, realize they have a desire to be a religious sister, and they get really afraid because they're like, "Oh no, I could never do that. Oh no, I could never be happy with that life. I could never be, you know," and they kind of put up barriers to God's call. And it's kind of understandable. It's kind of an intimidating thing, but it's funny almost. It's almost humorous that, like, I want to be a religious sister so bad, but I'm just scared that if I do that, I won't be happy. Wait, what? Wait, what? Wait. Rewind, play the tape, and listen to yourself say that. And I think that just really helps demystify a lot of things. Now, one of the things that one of the reasons discernment is important is because, as we see with the seminary, as we see with religious life, there's times where men enter the seminary, young women enter religious life, and they're like, they have a desire, and it's a real desire. I have a desire to be a priest. I have a desire to be a religious sister. And as they enter into that desire, and they start to live in that desire by God's grace, a lot, sometimes, you know, it's not infrequent that they will realize that that's not the deepest desire they have, that that desire is like something that was there and was real, but actually the deeper desire that they almost need to pass through that desire to an even deeper desire. And so you have young men who leave the seminary because they feel what their desire for fatherhood actually is meant to be realized as a married man, right? Same thing with religious sisters, where they have this intense desire to experience intimacy with Christ and kind of the spousal love. And then they realize in the convent that actually God is asking me to experience his spousal love through a flesh and blood man as a husband and father, so of my children. So these are all good things. This is kind of the important thing. And
Well, I think like with discernment, if you're talking about making a decision, it's not, you're not choosing between something good and something bad.
Correct,
You're
correct.
choosing between two goods.
Correct,
And
correct.
that's where I think a lot of people, it's like when I hear people talking about discernment, particularly within the context of like family planning, it's always in a negative context. And I love that you're focusing so much on the word desire. Because when we hear that word, we're like, ooh, dirty, like, ah, like this is bad, like this is hedonism. It's like, no, like the deepest desires of our heart is put there by God. And I love like just kind of refocusing on that. Yes, it can get taken and twisted and all that, and like be curious about what, like go deep into what that desire is, like you're talking about. But the desire in and of itself as something that is good, something that we should be seeking out. And I think too, like whenever we have like this weird twisted idea that like if we're going to follow Christ, we need to be miserable, right? And it's like, you know, you need to suffer, and like if you're not carrying your cross and all this type of stuff. And like, yes, there's totally that stuff. Like, I
right.
listen, I know that I was supposed to marry Nick when he proposed. I felt so much peace. But there's been some crosses that have been carried
sure.
since
yeah,
doing
right,
that, right? You know,
right,
I mean, like,
right,
it's
right,
not,
right,
there's definitely
right.
been some gruesome bits, but like overall, like there is so much joy and so much fulfillment. Like this has fulfilled the desires of my heart, desires that I would not have explored otherwise.
Right, right,
You know, and it's like,
right.
and that I love just kind of refocusing it that way as something positive. Because I think that we really do get caught up in focusing on the negative, and then it becomes fear-based, and it becomes like a glorification of suffering and all of these types of things. And it's like, no, Jesus said, like, I came that you may have life and have it more abundantly. Like, yeah, sometimes you're going to have to climb a few Calvaries to get to that, but that's the goal. That's the point. So if you are happy, it's not like, oh, this is bad because I'm happy and this is, you know, the world that we live in and I'm supposed to desire heaven, so I shouldn't be happy. It's like, how does that make sense? And so this reframe, I think, is just, it's such a good baseline to start from, that no, we
well,
have these deep desires. That's what we should be pursuing.
And just two things. I mean, one is, it would take a whole history lesson to kind of go into it, but I mean, like, it's Jansenism, right? That is, it's the American church in particular is profoundly impacted by the heresy of Jansenism, which is tied up with all of these things that you're talking about. It's one of the reasons American Catholicism has always been an outlier in modern history, is American Catholics have kind of, there's kind of this odd thing where we are a minority, and we're trying to function in a Protestant country. And yet the Protestant culture around us, which is Puritan in many ways, and is something that, you know, and Jansenism, of course, is kind of Irish Calvinism, right? So you have kind of these different things happening where the Irish Catholic Church is impacted by the Protestant culture that we live in, which kind of compounds already the heretical problems that were happening in the Irish Church at the time of many of the immigrations that happened. So that's an entire history lesson we don't really need
to
go into.
Well, it's funny you bring that up, because I've actually talked about that on my platforms a lot.
Oh, okay, sure.
The Jansenist heresy. Yeah, no, whenever I started digging
super
into that,
bad.
I was like, oh, this makes so much sense. Yes.
Yeah, it's super bad. Yeah. It's super bad. And it attacks this kind of fundamental core belief of the church and of right reason, right? Yeah. Which is that all desire is good. All desire.
Yeah.
You don't have any desires that are bad. You have desires that have been corrupted by sin. You have desires. So in the sense that, so if, when I say, like, sometimes when I say the phrase, all desires are good, some people get really uncomfortable, because they're like, because they rightly say, and they have a point, and they say, no, like, sometimes people desire really bad things. And I say, yes, that's right. Sometimes people do desire really bad things, but the desires they have are good. They're desiring really bad things because they're taking something that is good and it's being corrupted, which is what sin always does. Sin always twists, it always corrupts, it always makes something worse. So I think that, like, when we say it's such an important place to begin as far as discernment being rooted in desire, there's a really good book by Ralph Martin, published back in the 80s, I think. It might be more recent than that, but anyway, the book by Ralph Martin is called The Fulfillment of All Desire. And it's considered by many priests already to be a spiritual classic, because the whole book is just a walk through eight of the great saints of the church and their approach to the spiritual life. Everybody from Teresa of Avila, Bernard of Clairvaux, Catherine of Siena, the Little Flower. And the whole thing is about it's all about what I'm talking about. The saints, the church herself and her saints, they speak about desire the way that I'm speaking about it, right? So I think sometimes when people get uncomfortable and they're like, wow. And the other thing that's funny is when people say things like, wow, this is such a new take on discernment. And my response is, no, it's an old take.
Yeah, you were telling me that. You were like, everybody was coming out the woodwork after that video got posted. Yeah. They were like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And what did you told me this past weekend? What did you tell me?
I think I said something like, yeah, sure. I mean, I didn't.
No, you were
any,
like, I just reworded things that have
I just
already
re-
been
yes,
said.
That's right. That's what I said. Yes. I just reworded things that have been said by the saints for centuries.
Which is like, which is not a small thing. And like, my point back to you is like, you're making it accessible. Like, Nobody's going to go pick up the book by Bernard of Clairvaux because they're going to be like, oh my gosh, he was born in what century? Like, there's no way I can read that. But if a baby priest comes out and starts talking about it, it's like, okay, now I can listen. Which, by the way, he is a baby priest. He's been a priest for 2.5 months now.
2.5 months.
Two
Yeah,
and a
two and
half
a half
months.
months.
Baby
Yeah,
priest.
super experienced.
Yes. Well, you know, listen, it's, hey,
But
wisdom is
I
wisdom.
didn't
Yeah.
just what is it? I was doing marriage prep the other night, and this couple in marriage prep asked me a couple of ethical questions, let us say, and about a number of different things, about a number of different things.
Dude,
And
we
I
don't have to
like
use euphemisms here.
I
To protect the
said,
couple, I understand.
right. The names of the guilty will be left out to protect
Oh,
them. But
Lord.
it was no, it was actually kind of endearing because they were really curious about a bunch of different things, everything from IVF to like medical, when certain medical interventions are permissible and things like this. So like we talked about this for like an hour and a half, and they had a lot of questions. They were really intellectually curious. And at one point the guy, like, it was really funny. The gentleman was like, "Father, how do you know all this stuff?" And I was like, I didn't just pick this color up at 7-Eleven on the way over here. I have been educated in the heart of the church for years. Like,
Yeah.
it's not
It's
like
not like you
I'm
just like woke up one day and it was like, you know, the sky's parted, the sunbeams came down, and you were just, oh, wise. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's another thing that it's tough for people. There needs to be this kind of the teachings of the church need to be made accessible, because I think a lot of people are just super intimidated. Like, I will talk all the time on my platforms. I'm like, y'all read Humanae Vitae, it's totally readable. And people are like,
No, it's
what?
super readable. It's
It's
super
a
readable.
papal encyclical. How is it readable? I'm like, it really
It's
is. I
readable.
promise. I promise. It's like probably one of the shortest ones. Yeah. So anyway, but this is like, yeah, it's not a small thing. Like, this is the challenge of teaching. And I know Fulton Sheen, he was like, you know, knowledge is broken down to suit the mind to which it is given. Like, but you have to be able to take that knowledge and break it down. Like, that's a skill. That's and not everybody has it.
Well,
I'm learning.
C.S. Lewis famously said that C.S. Lewis famously said that he thought that the final test of seminarians before they were ordained priests was the final should be they have to go to the docks of London, and they have to be able to like get a bunch of dock workers in a room, and then like a doctrine of the church is pulled out of a hat, and they have to explain whatever doctrine's pulled out of the hat to the dock workers in a way they like understand and can repeat back to him after like 20 minutes or something. Like, you have 20 minutes to explain this to dock workers. You have
That is
20 minutes to
brilliant.
explain the Holy Trinity to dock workers. Go. And like, that should be the final for all priests in C.S. Lewis's mind, is because for the reason you're saying, he
Yeah.
was like, you have to be able to take like very technical things that we have to have right in order to be able to understand the truth. But like, God gave these things to us to be understood. So, and this is the
Yeah.
reason for the incarnation, right? Like, one of the core ways that we talk about divine revelation, period, is the phrase the church uses is accommodated to human intelligence. The divine revelation, of the triune infinite God is accommodated to human intelligence.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that in preaching I'm constantly thinking about.
Yeah.
When I give my homilies every day, much less every Sunday, I'm constantly thinking about exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. And I think what's important to note there too is that in order to accommodate human intelligence, the truth cannot be revealed all at once. And I know that drives some people bonkers, because they're
Oh,
like,
super.
yeah, but it's like, no, you would be overwhelmed. And then, like, God is not a gentleman if he's just gonna like spray you down with a fire hose and like just take it all right now. It's like, no, it's slowly revealed over time. And I think
Do you
that
want me to
that's what.
reveal those people's fear, which is really uncharitable of me? They want to be
Oh,
in control, right?
you said it,
Control
not
is
me.
like the
I was just
control. I'm
thinking
sorry.
it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it
Yeah.
is, right? It's
Yeah.
when we demand, whenever we demand that God like act in ways that are easy for us, or we demand that God behave in a certain way, it's always because we're scared deep down. We have
Yep.
this deep, deep
Yes.
core fear that we're not
Yes.
really in control. And the terrifying thing is that we're actually not in control. Like, this is like the funny
Right.
thing that
Right.
people don't like it when I tell them that, but I tell people semi-frequently in my profession, like,
I
hey,
can't imagine what context.
I know, right? Do you know that you're not in control of your own life? And they're like, what? Like, you're not in
Yeah.
control of your own life. You're in control of you're in control of, in a limited way, of how you respond to the things that happen to you. That's what you're in control of. And if this conversation is any like reflection of how much control you even have there, but people, I think people are so used to thinking that they're in control in our modern context, because of the technology we have access to, because of the way we live our lives. People are no, I'm in control to the point where I can get into a box and I can take that box 50 miles away and be there in less than an hour. And I don't even need to walk anywhere. I can I'm in control of my location in this totally insane way that's never been possible before 75 years ago. Right. And that transcends to all the other ways that people feel like they're in control. And now the illusion, of course, with filters and things on cameras, right? Like people, especially online, feel like I'm even in control of how I look. I'm in control of how I'm perceived.
Yeah.
If you think you're in control of how you're perceived by people, this is
work in politics for 5 seconds. Yes, no.
right.
Yeah.
It's really, and I see it all the time, especially in young women. There's this intense desire to control how people perceive them. And it's liberating for them once they realize that they can't do that. Mm-hmm. When they realize they can't do it, first they're afraid. They're like, oh, this really sucks. And then it's like, no. This is really good. This is really, really good.
Listen, when I hit 30 and I no longer cared about people's opinions like I used to, it was the most liberating moment of my life. Exactly. I was like, this is awesome. Oh, man. Yeah. No, it was great. I mean, I still care. I haven't hit 40 yet, but I've hit 30. So I'm like, anyway.
Right.
I think this is something that I've noticed too, is like, it is this desire for control. And what I see kind of underneath that, let's call out the facts and then let's dig into the emotional side of it too, is that there's this, it's uncomfortable to not be sure of an outcome. Mm-hmm. And I think that for is sure. That's what we're shying away from, is it this discomfort with the lack of surety. And I totally see it pop up in the spiritual life. And again, talking about family planning stuff, it's like, well, I need to make sure that I'm making the right decision, because if I make the wrong decision, then I'm going to sin. And then that's a really bad thing. And then I might go to hell. And I'm like, woo, hold up, dial it back here a little bit. We're not supposed to be motivated by that type of fear. That type of fear is crippling.
Right.
It's crippling. Right. It's not liberating. It's not living in love. It's like love says, no, you can make an honest mistake. And that's what I think that to me, the biggest problem with discernment is, even whenever you're talking about desires and then you're like, wait, some desires are bad. It's messy. This is not a clear cut thing. This is something where, yes, I'm going to try to dig into my desires, but I might get it wrong. My desires might be wrongfully ordered and I might pursue that for a time, but it's like, I think that we forget, or maybe we just don't know. Maybe we've just never experienced that God is not sitting up there just waiting to make the wrong move on the chessboard and just swatting us, that's not how it works. And really it's scrupulosity. It's a scrupulous tendency. And I think that a lot of people don't realize that that's what's going on. And they think it's virtuous. It's like, no, I'm trying to avoid sin. I'm like, yeah, but what's your motivation? What's your motivation? If you are deathly afraid, that's not the right motivation to not sin. It's like, and of course, then you're getting into perfect and imperfect contrition, right? I don't want to go to hell. That's good enough. But also take it the next step. It's like, you don't want to hurt someone you love. You don't want to hurt God, right? Because you love him, right? And so it's a different motivation. And I think that we're allowed to struggle and get to a point where that becomes our motivation. And we're allowed to fall short of that mark. We have the ideal and then we have where we are. And I think that we just forget, hey, we live in a fallen world. It ain't perfect. And it's not going to be perfect. And that was where the book... I think it was Interior Freedom by Father Jacques.
Yeah, great book.
But he talks about, or maybe it was Interior, maybe it was Searching for and Maintaining Peace. I've gotten them confused at this point. They've just blended together because I read them very close.
They're both
together.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Oh man, talk about kick your butt. He was talking about how the perfection that we're trying to pursue is not literally never doing anything wrong.
Right.
He said, in the Gospels, who is the most perfect? It's the one who loves. That's it. And it's if the motivation is love, if the intention is love, we can mess up, we can make mistakes, we can discern and get it wrong, But if our pursuit was, I want to know what is that deep desire in my heart? And maybe we missed the mark, but that was the pursuit. That was the goal. That was the intention. Like, God will work out the kinks. Like, he will figure it out.
Yeah. And there's a marked difference in how woundedness kind of results from those things, right? Like, so if you're pursuing your desires from a place of fear, and then you allow your selfishness and your brokenness and your sinfulness to kind of dictate how you, you know, maybe do sin in some way. If you're acting out of that kind of vicious kind of place, and you do make the same mistake that somebody makes when they're acting out of love, right? The way that manifests itself in woundedness is markedly different. Both of those things will wound you, right? Like, both of those things will wound the person, but one of those wounds will be much, much deeper and will be much more of something that will tangle you up in the times that come down the road, because again, you're acting from a place of fear, and you're acting from a place then of trying to control the situation, and you know, like all kinds of other things like resentment and anger and bitterness can climb in there. Whereas somebody who makes an authentic mistake, and they make the mistake because they're rooted in love, but they're either imprudent in some way, or they have, like, they lack knowledge in some way. So for example, I mean, you have, you know, like an easy example, it would be something where, like, you have two young people, like teenagers or like 17 or 18, and they're very much in love, and they think that they really want to get married someday, and then they begin to sleep together. Okay. This is a real problem, right? And this is something that's wounding them. It's hurting them, but that's very, very different than, right, someone who is a young woman who's really scared her boyfriend will not stay with her if she doesn't sleep with him. So then she begins to sleep with him so that he'll stay around. Like, the way that those wounds manifest in those two respective teenage girls are very different, and they both need to be addressed. Both are sinful, both need to be addressed, but they both, like how damaging they are to that person is actually going to be fairly different. And that's one of the things that is helpful in healing from such things, is when people, because people have to forgive themselves very often for their past mistakes, and that's hard for them. But like, it's actually much easier for the girl who just thought she was loving her boyfriend to forgive herself than the girl who was trying to manipulate, was trying to be in control, was trying to, like, all the other things. Like, it's much harder for her to forgive herself because the desire is much more twisted, and because the motivation is markedly different.
And the desire for the woman who's, like, sleeping to keep the boyfriend is, like, she's for whatever reason has gotten to a point where she feels like she's not lovable, she's not valuable, unless she's giving something of herself away. And that is a very different thing. That's a really good point too. And I think, again, I'm always, like, bringing it back to, like, the family planning stuff, because that's what deal with on a daily basis. But I think, like, you know, let's say, for example, the couple who is trying to avoid pregnancy, right? And this is something that everybody, like, every NFP week, for the love of all things holy, somebody comes out and is like, well, you can use it with a contraceptive mentality. And I'm like, do you even know the context in which that phrase first originated? Anyway, no, they don't. But that's another podcast episode. Go listen to episode 8. listeners, you can listen to it too. I get really nerdy with encyclicals, even pulling out Cassie Canubi. Anyway,
love Cassie Canubi.
I know. Oh, it's so good. Now I've gone on a tangent and I forgot where I was going. Okay. Try to avoid. All right. So let's say, for example, that you are doing it for a selfish reason. Okay. There is, like, an underlying selfishness, but at the same time, maybe there is, like, this motivation of love of, like, my husband, it's like, you know, we have, like, this history of, you know, there's brokenness in our own families, and we're just terrified of having a child. So it's just like, we're just not going to have a child right now. I would argue that that's actually a valid reason to avoid, because that fear needs to be addressed first. I think that, you know, just trying to have a child in that context, you're actually causing a further wounding, because there's not a freedom. You're not making a free choice, essentially. Like, there's a level of force there. If you're just being told, and this is where I think things get really sticky whenever you're talking about asking for advice in this area, especially from people who don't understand the full situation, because if you have a situation where people are just being told that like the default selfless disposition is to have a child, it is discounting so many things that maybe even the couple themselves aren't fully aware of. And I've encountered that where like over time, the longer a couple like practices NFP and avoids these issues, and I've talked to women where this has happened, these issues will come up and they're like, oh, there's like this deep fear that I have, maybe because like I actually was parentified when I was a kid. Like I was in charge of being a parent to my siblings. And so I'm terrified of having a child because I didn't have a childhood, you know? And it's like, okay, well, let's deal with that first. And in the meantime, like, yeah, I think, you know, if you're avoiding pregnancy and like, but you're also dealing with this simultaneously, the point is like, this gets into something so big, and like on the surface, maybe you're seeing something selfish, but there's something so much deeper there that needs to be dealt with. And the question then becomes like, okay, well, what is the timeline on that? And like, you can't put a timeline because it is so widely variable person to person. And this is where I think that that discernment, that desire comes back in a very positive way, right? Like, what is your desire? I think, you know, in situations like this, our deepest desire is to be healed. We want to be whole. And I think that like, if that's the goal, if the goal is wholeness, if the goal is healing, then that kind of takes care of the quote unquote problem of avoiding pregnancy, right? If you have these deep issues that are real, that are preventing you from living the life that you have been called to live, dealing with that is the thing that will help you pursue that deeper desire. I kind of took this off on like a random tangent, but I want to go there.
Okay, sure, sure. No, I think that, so I think that the only thing that I want to maybe give a tiny bit of pushback on is I think that, and I want to like highlight a lot of what you said, because I agree with pretty much everything, is I think that the church does ask us, asks all married couples to, that the default is to be, default is to have a child. That is, that is because this is the purpose of marriage. The purpose of marriage is to have a family, right? And I think that when people understand that, I think that that makes it, that's why we're rooted in having a child as the default, is because the very purpose of marriage and the very purpose of sexual intimacy is to have a child. So, and obviously that's connected to, that's connected to experience of unity between the spouses and mutual love and self-gift. So,
and actually, that's not too much of a pushback, because I agree. And that's a good point. That's a good point to bring out. And I just want to highlight that for a second, that that is the default. And this is actually something that I've thought about, that the reasons that we have for avoiding pregnancy that are valid reasons are pretty much all of them, if you start digging into them, are the result of our living in a fallen world. They're not the ideal, you know, like whatever. So like in Humanae Vitae, it was psychological, social, economic, physical. All of those things are like, when you dig into that, like if you're not physically capable of carrying another pregnancy, or you have children who maybe have special needs, or like, you know, situations with your parents that require, whatever your situation is, that's all the result of living in a fallen world.
So
I think, and it's, so anyway, just to highlight this, it is a good reminder that like, yes, the default is to have children because that is a good, but the reasons that we have for avoiding it is part of the reality of living in a fallen world. And so it's like,
So I think, I had a soccer coach in college who once used the phrase, he said, gentlemen, there are reasons you can mispractice, but there's never an excuse to mispractice. And I really, really liked that distinction. I do. Yeah, I like that distinction. Because I think that I would say there's reasons why couples might want to, should, I'll use that phrase. There are reasons couples should defer a pregnancy, right? But there are not ever, and there's never an excuse to defer a pregnancy. That's what I would say. And I think that everybody kind of hears the difference when they hear those two words, right? Because I think that there's a way of making excuses. There's a way of kind of, and I think that, and so here's one thing that I've learned, in my, not only 2.5 months of priesthood, but also just through 6 years of seminary and kind of conversations with married friends, you know, friends like yourself. And
I was going to say, we've been friends for 10 years, and this is not the first time that we've had a conversation sort of like this.
Totally true. Totally true. Shocker. I know.
Your listeners are like, you were on the debate team at Christendom. So I mean,
I was, So no, exactly. So I think that one of the things I've learned is that every situation is different and every couple is different. And yeah. I think that the church speaks in principles, and those principles have to be applied. And I think that's really important. So one of the things that I've learned is you can never, ever, ever judge a couple from the outside when you're not seeing pregnancy happen.
When I share this episode, that's going to be the clip I grab and share.
Okay, sure.
Just that,
but
right there.
But it's true because I think that I can remember judging people, you know, as a young man who's like zealous, trying to live the faith zealously, trying to follow mm-hmm. the Lord, and we live in a counter, you know, in an anti-culture in many ways. We live in a culture that is so viciously hostile to an authentic understanding of marriage, to an authentic understanding of femininity, and an authentic understanding of what it means to give oneself as a gift. And so I think mm-hmm. that when you live in a kind of anti-culture, it's easy to overreact. That doesn't excuse overreacting.
Yes.
I'm giving myself an excuse, right? Notice I'm not saying that I didn't have a reason to judge couples, right, when I was a younger man, but I had excuses why I was judging them, right? Because we're living in this anti-culture, we're living in this, that, you know. Yeah. But one of the things you realize is that you just have to, at least for me, like I just had to find out a couple of things, and all of a sudden it changed my whole perspective, right?
Yeah.
Like when you find out that there's a couple that you're like, oh, they've been married 5 years. I wonder why they're not having a kid. Like, and you see that they're, and you even make the, you're like, well, they have some money. They don't have a lot of money, but they have, they definitely have enough. Yep. And you kind of start, you let your mind go down these judgmental pathways.
Yep.
And then you find out like they can't have children.
Yep.
That he is infertile. Yep. Right. Or that she is infertile. And then you feel horrible because you have judged people who are suffering. You've judged people who are suffering. And it's, you know, you only have to have a couple experiences, at least in my life, right? Only had to have a couple experiences of seeing people who are really suffering to realize, like, and it might not even have been infertility. There could have been other things going on. And
miscarriage, then you realize, like, you never know.
You never know. And so one thing that I have learned is you never, ever, 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 ever judge a couple. And now as a priest, I'm in the position where I have the privilege of couples like coming to ask me questions and coming to meet with me, and then I can help them mm-hmm. discern, are you making an excuse or do you have a reason? Are you making an excuse or do you have a reason? And they say, and sometimes they say, I don't know, I'm trying to understand. And you're just like, okay, sweet. Let's walk together. Let's pray together. Let's do this together. So I think that's one thing that I find very, very helpful in all of these conversations is that every couple's situation is different.
Yeah.
And every couple's situation is their own. And so I think that it's vitally important that always be maintained while at the same time maintaining everything you and I have just said about like the principles and like kind of the default position. And I think one thing that's hard about your line of work is that I think that there's a tendency, at least I've seen a tendency to overanalyzing things, which makes it hard because you're trying to be responsible. You're trying to be reasonable. You're trying to be like, you're trying to live the faith, holistically. One of the things that I think can really happen that's very, very difficult for people is I think that people can really get bogged down in overanalyzing things. And I think this is one of the things I would say to people is when you're discerning about whether or not to have another child, and you really think there might be a good reason not to, I wouldn't pray about that decision for very long. I would pray about the decision and speak, and obviously communication between the spouses is super vital. But like when you're deciding to do something like that, you're making a self-sacrificial decision for yourself and for your spouse, right? You're sacrificing something in your marriage that is a big part of your marriage, right? And so you're sacrificing that. And so just constantly revisiting it and just constantly going over it again and again and again and again and again from different angles, I just don't think it's helpful. And I think it torments people, and it makes people feel deeply frustrated by the fact that they even have to think about this at all. So I think one thing that I would say to people is like, look, we're going to pray about this and think about this, and you guys are going to talk about this, but again, I've only been a priest for 2.5 months, but one thing, I just think that it's important for people not to overanalyze this.
Yeah.
And I understand why they do, because it's a big decision. It's a big thing. But I think it's important that when we're St. Thomas breaks down prudence into a couple different things, right? St. Thomas says that prudence has the first step of prudence is to take counsel, gather information, talk to people, get advice, right? The second part of prudence, right, is the actual consideration of that counsel, the mm-hmm. actual, like, looking at what you've been told and kind of looking at it. And then St. Thomas says the third part of prudence is the most important, which is do it. Actually mm-hmm. do the thing, right?
Yeah.
And I think one of the things,
or not do the thing as the case may be.
Or not do the thing as the case may be. Right. Or not as the case may be. But I think that this is one of the things that so many people kind of feel, and this it's not just in areas of family planning, but in other areas of life where people are like, I'm just gonna take counsel for weeks, months.
Yeah.
And then I'm gonna think about the counsel I've received for weeks.
Yeah.
And for months.
Nick calls it analysis paralysis.
Yeah, no, totally. And that's what it is. Yeah, and that's what it is, right?
Yeah.
And I think that just, and I think in matters of family planning, I think just for your own sanity and for your spouse's sanity, like making a decision rooted in the good, rooting in, I'm really trying to pursue the good. And like you said earlier, if you make a mistake, you've made a mistake, but like, don't getting caught up in like, oh my gosh, do I have a really good reason? Oh my gosh, I just don't know. Like, determine that by talking to friends, talk to people you trust, talk to your priest, take counsel, pray about it with your spouse, talk about it with your spouse, and then make a decision.
Yeah.
And then if you revisit the decision every month, okay, like you're revisiting this but if you're revisiting the decision every 3 days,
it doesn't work crippling. Like that because you ain't ovulating all the time. But
right,
you know.
Well, that's true. Right. No, sure.
It's going to be once a cycle. No, but I think this is good, and I'm running low on my time, so I wanted to get into just a couple other things. One of the things that we kind of talked about with planning this was that discernment. We think about it with like these big events, right? Like you mm-hmm, discern mm-hmm, your vocation, mm-hmm, you discern mm-hmm. whether or not you're having a child, but discernment is like, it's really a daily thing. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the point that I try to make with people, because it feels big and overwhelming when you have to mm-hmm, learn this skill in order to make mm-hmm. a big decision. But like, mm-hmm. if you practice this skill on mm-hmm. a daily basis, just this quiet, like this daily, like even just as simple as like from moment to moment, like, Jesus, like, God, what are you calling me to right now? And mm-hmm. just learning to tune into the way that he speaks to you. Mm-hmm. And again, like using that, the tool of like following your desire. What mm-hmm. do I want to do right now? Like, what is the best mm-hmm. thing that I want to do right now? Like for me mm-hmm. as a mom, it's like, I really would love to just like check out and scroll Instagram. But what I want, what I'm doing with this is like, I actually want connection. Mm-hmm. Okay. So maybe how can I cultivate this connection with my children? Like,
yes,
so
exactly.
That is like digging into that root desire. Like, so absolutely. That's kind of just kind of like a daily discernment question, right?
No, super
I
good.
Don't
super good example.
Want to
super
wash
good example.
The dishes, but it's unsanitary to eat on them when mm-hmm. they're dirty.
Right.
Okay. Anyway.
Right.
So that
sometimes following your desire is hard. Following your desire is hard.
Yes.
I love the example you just gave. I love the example you just gave because it's a great example of, I want, like, the desire that I have doesn't mean it's easy. And I think that's one of the lies that the enemy of our humanity, as St. Ignatius of Loyola calls him, one of the lies that the enemy of our humanity wants to tell us is, if you really wanted this, it would be easy. And that's just not true. That's mm-hmm. just not true. So many of the desires we have are not easy. Right. But that doesn't mean they're not worth doing. Right.
Right.
And then some of the desires we have are super easy, right?
Yeah.
A desire's goodness or its place in our life is not determined on a hierarchy by how easy it is, right?
Yeah.
So like you know, being with your husband when you really want to be with your husband is pretty easy, right? Like that's it's not hard.
Can confirm.
Right. But like you know, I think that's why the example you gave is so great, is because it's an important thing that people have to remember about their desires is. Just like, I really, really want this good thing. Why is it so hard? because we're broken, because we're fallen, and our hearts are not fully ordered to the love of our Father through the person of our brother and our Savior in the Holy Spirit, right? And our hearts are being molded slowly over time to desire things that we should desire more, and for it to be easier to fulfill those desires. I mean, St. Thomas does kind of emphasize that it does, if we really live in those desires. St. Thomas says that they will get easier, and that some of them will never be easy, but they will be easier, right? Yeah. And just one thing that's just right on this point, I think, and I tell people this all the time. Say St. Francis de Sales says that in order to be holy, we have to be patient, beginning with patience with ourselves.
Oh,
right?
Yes.
Right? Like St.
That's
Francis
the worst.
Really,
that's the worst
that.
Thing I've ever heard. But yes, it's also the best thing I've ever heard, because it's like patience is the worst.
I know.
It is the worst.
I know. But it's so helpful, isn't it? And again, it's just wisdom of the saints. St. Francis de Sales was preaching 4 centuries ago, you know? And it's like, okay, like this is like, it's patience with ourselves in our weakness.
Yeah.
In our weakness.
Kind of building off of that, Nick's got a friend that he grew up with who is now a priest in out in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. But he said something similar. He was like, from a different source, I don't remember the source, but mm-hmm. he was like, it's not that we say that we hate change. He's like, we don't hate change. We love what comes at the end of the process of change. It's just, we hate the process. Like, right. and that's what you're talking, like the patience to go through that process to get to like the end result. Mm-hmm. That's the part that we hate. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, if we go to 1 Corinthians 13, like what is the first thing he says? Love is patient.
Love is patient.
Yeah. So yeah, if we're motivated by love, if our desires are rooted in love, there has to be patience.
Dang it.
Okay. So great. This is all great. We're talking about all these desires, like motivated by desires, mm-hmm. like positive, great, wonderful. Okay. So what happens when these desires don't get fulfilled?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I have this great desire. God has placed it on my heart. We want another child. We want another child so badly, but we can't have a child because we have health issues. There's infertility. Or like we have a really serious reason to avoid a pregnancy right now. I really want to be united with my husband right now, but I know that will result in a pregnancy and we cannot handle that right now. So what, when these desires that we have, which are good, are delayed, deferred, not fulfilled, what do we do about that?
Yeah. And this is obviously one of the things that is most difficult is when good desires are not able to be fulfilled. And so I think that's just one thing I want to say just right off the bat is like appreciating kind of the sacredness of the ground that we tread on when we speak about people who have really good desires that can't be fulfilled. Mm-hmm. It's very important to recognize the intensity of that.
Yeah.
And to be compassionate and really patient with people who are suffering with that. That's the first thing. Second thing is, so I think that it's very, very important to always remember at the heart of when you have a frustrated good desire, I think to realize that at the heart of that desire is a desire to experience the goodness and the love of God. And I think that that's like, and one of the deepest ways that human beings experience the goodness and the love of God is when God gives them a child. I mean, this is one of the greatest, it's the greatest natural good that God gives anybody is besides outside of his own divine life and baptism and the sacraments, right? The greatest good he really gives somebody is the life of a child. So when you have something that's that intensely good, and there's an authentic desire, there's a context within marriage where it's able to happen and it can't happen. I think that what the saints have said to us is that what is being asked of there is an experience of the desire that God has for us in leading us out of our sinfulness. Right? Like the experience that, when, as much as you desire just using the child as an example, and that desire is being frustrated, it is an invitation, a difficult invitation. It's a difficult invitation to enter into the passion of our Lord Jesus Christ so that you can experience his love for you in his suffering, because your suffering then becomes part of his suffering. Him on the cross is feeling your pain and not being able to have another child. And then you, with him on the cross, are feeling his pain and his agony, longing for the souls of his brothers and sisters who are not in the state of grace. So it's a very, very, very difficult invitation. It really is. And it's one of the hardest things. It's one of the hardest things to kind of walk with people through that, because so often people don't want to hear that. So it's so important just to meet them where they are and to like pray with them where they are, but to invite them into the very suffering of God. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the only answer that we as the church has, right? And it's a tough answer. It's a difficult answer, but it is the answer. Yeah. And again, I just want to emphasize patience with yourself in such a suffering is vitally important, because someone is ready to hear what I've just said, and they receive that into their heart and they're like, okay, I'm willing to suffer with Jesus. And yet at times they don't, at times they rebel, at times they start screaming and shaking their fist at God. And then they go back and they think, I can't believe it. I just can't believe I did that. I can't believe I yelled at God. I can't believe I was angry at God. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. And I think that one of the things that people have to distinguish between, and this is super important, is, and so many people don't do this, you have to distinguish between your sin and your weakness. Mm-hmm. So many people think, my weakness is sinful.
Yeah.
This is a lie. It is not true. If your weakness was sinful, then the Lord Jesus would have been sinning by becoming a human being who would suffer and die. Then the Virgin Mary would have been sinning by being a human being who was able to be emotionally hurt and wounded and crushed by what was happening to her son. The Lord Jesus became weak for our sake, and he did not sin. Our Blessed Mother was weak on this earth with him in his suffering, in his ministry. So I think that one of the things that I really want to emphasize to people who are really suffering and who are impatient with themselves to be united with the Lord Jesus in his suffering, of which there are many good people who suffer from this kind of impatience with themselves. One of the things that I've seen that is so important is that they don't consider their weakness sin. Mm-hmm. They consider their sin sin. Sin is a deliberate action. Sin is something I'm choosing. So I think that that's one of the ways that we can grow in patience with ourselves, especially when we're dealing with a really heavy cross, like unfulfilled good desires, deep desires. One of the most important things we can do is be patient with ourselves and not judge ourselves for being weak, right? I think that's just patience with yourself, because God is patient with you. God doesn't get tired of you repenting. This is one of the crazy things about our God, is he doesn't get tired of us saying sorry.
We get tired of asking for forgiveness.
right.
No, I'm here again. Yeah.
It's true.
No,
this, but it's so important.
No, it's funny. As you were talking, I heard so many things that I needed to hear from the other end of the spectrum. Because what you were describing, I experienced through having children. And so, you know, you're gonna get that cross. And I think that that's like what you're talking about, the compassion. It's like, meet people where they are. Don't lead with you're getting this beautiful invitation. It's like, right, well, it freaking sucks. Thanks so much. Right, you know, let's deal with the sucky parts. And I always take people back to Calvary. Like let's look at how Jesus did this. First of all, he started off in a garden where he sweat blood over this. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Was not happy. Yeah. And he bargained. Yeah. He bargained. Right. Lord, right. If it's possible, let this cup pass.
Right.
You know? Right. So it's fun. Yeah. And like you said, like, that's a weakness. Mm-hmm. And it's fine for us to be like, I'd really rather not do this cross.
Right.
And I've actually had somebody tell me, because I was like, get this cross off of me. Hard pass on all of this. This sucks. I'm a sanguine. I like to have fun. Right. And this is miserable. Right. I want a party. This is not a party. I'm done. So not like me. I know. Mm-hmm. But shocking. I know. Right. Just, yeah. But somebody told me, they were like, if you do have, like, God exists outside of time. So even if you do remember this time where you like kind of shirk this cross, like, you can go back and be like, God, okay, I give it to you now. Mm-hmm. I take it on now. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I think that the things of our past that maybe we flubbed, like they're not lost because God exists outside of time. Like we can always, and not like in a way that's obsessive, but we can always
Sure,
go
sure.
back to that and be like, okay, I give this to you now. I accept this now. I see what you were doing now. Like that is still like a beautiful offering. Like it's not worse, you know. It's like, again, it's the difference between weakness and sin. I love that you made that distinction, because I didn't even think about that. But yeah, thinking with my own story, it was like hard pass on these crosses. It's like, that was a weakness. That was a weakness. But I can also say, go back later and be like, yep, that was not my proudest moment. But yeah. And I think too, like, when we were talking about this, we talked about the book that we love, The Read of God. And she talks about it, which was so interesting. When I read this book, everybody's like, it's a book about Mary. And I'm like, really? Like, this is a book about Jesus. What are you talking about? It's like, yes, there's a lot of Mary there, but it's so much a book about Jesus. And I'm like, that is just the sum total of what being devoted to the Blessed Mother is about. Like, you're so devoted to the Blessed Mother. And then all of a sudden it's just like, oh, there's just Jesus everywhere. And it's like, yep.
Yes. Yes.
That's
precisely.
How it works.
Yep.
That's how it works. But in the book she was talking about, and again, I'm not like saying this in a way that's dismissive, but this is certainly something that like I've experienced whenever I was like hanging there, bleeding, whatever. And this, she uses the moments in Christ's life, like when Mary loses Jesus when he's a child, right? And it's this searching and this seeking that sometimes God does leave us because he's like, come after me. You know, and I experienced that as abandonment, and it was brutal. It was awful. Like I was experiencing like the worst period of my life. And then on top of that, I literally couldn't feel God, you know, and it's just, but that, like, I'm looking back at it now and I'm realizing that I'm having to rebuild my relationship with him. And that's what is happening, is like, there is this searching, like, God, I want you. Like there's this, and I only realized this recently. That's what was going on. So like 5 years after everything happened. So patience again. But yeah, it does. It's so true. I think it, and even at the ascension, when Jesus left, he's like, it's good for me to leave. You know, because now it's like we're searching for him. We're trying, like we want to get to him. We're seeking. And the thing is that we also have to remember is that it's not just us going out to receive God, to find God. He's simultaneously searching for us. Like it's really a meet in the middle, or like a meet three quarters of the way, and we've gone a quarter of the way, really, honestly. Like that's probably being generous, but
it's one of the, it's again, it goes back to the experience of desire, right? When like, when you go down into the depths of your heart and you pray and you're allowing, you know, God to really move you into the depths of your heart, wherever you go in your heart, you're going to open up some door. All of us have this experience. We open up some door in your heart you didn't know was there, and you walk into the room and the Lord is already there, right? He's been there. And I think that's, he's been looking for you and waiting for you all at the same time in your heart, deep in your heart. And I think that it's such a beautiful thing that you're able to experience, you know, that this deeper healing and a deeper intimacy with him through like wrestling with and going back over things that happened 5 years ago. That's really, really powerful. And it's so important. It's so, so important. And that the fact that God has led you there, he's led you to that place, right? He's led you to this place to like, where like you're talking to him about all this stuff. And then he kind of like almost kind of gives you a head nod. Like, hey, can you like, just like, I just want you to check out, just check out what was going on back there. And you're like,
And what's funny is I still don't like it.
I know, right? I know. No,
I'm still like, yeah, but you're God. You could have done it any way you wanted to. Did you have to do it that way? definitely had some of those moments. But and I think like part of the journey too, by the way, just kind of going back to like weakness and like part of it was getting angry at God and giving him my anger. And I think we forget that's super a prayer important. Too. That's a prayer too. I
Read
love
the Psalms.
What was that? No, my favorite is the hissy fit in Numbers that Moses
gives.
Oh,
sure.
That's
Oh
my favorite.
yeah, that's a good temper tantrum.
Oh, it was so fantastic. I resonated with that so much, where he's just like, "This is the people you've given me. Just kill me now, because I'm done." I'm like, what was the chapter and verse? It was like
Oh, I don't know, but
numbers.
it's
We're Catholics. We
I
don't
know
know chapter and
we don't
verse.
know chapter and verse, but I do. But it's a very distinct moment in Numbers, yeah, where
That
Yahweh
dude.
was, you're shouldering me with this stiff-necked
With
people. If you will
stiff-necked
not,
people, just
if you won't remove them from me, like just kill me. Like I just
kill
can't
me,
do it. I just can't do it
literally.
anymore. And God's like, no, you can do it. And he's like,
I know. Well, like every mother needs, like, she's got that letter board hanging somewhere in her house. That needs to be the verse
Yes, totally
that she
true.
puts on her letter board. Go find the hissy fit from Moses. It's just any day with a bad, like, bad day with the kids. Just look at that. Yep, that's me today.
That's me. That's me today.
Yeah, and again, that weakness versus, and I think what's beautiful about that, when I read it, I resonated with it so much, because I was just like, he's giving that tantrum to God. Like, that's a prayer. Anytime he's being honest, there is just a brutal honesty there. And this is the thing I always like to
Absolutely.
remind people, is that we serve the God of truth. And if we serve the God of truth, like, my prayer used to be like this very nice,
Yeah, of course.
contained, like, and then as I grew up and got mature, I was like, listen, Jesus, like, I don't know what you're smoking up in heaven, but I hope we don't have that brand on earth, because we got enough problems, like just a lot more, like, real, like, he became a person. Like, he came to us as a person. That was the whole point, was to establish
No,
this
it's true.
relationship. So,
It's really true. And people, this is something that I'm constantly trying to teach people when I teach people to pray. And the main time I teach people to pray is in the confessional, believe it or not, because I'm just trying to give them like little
well,
tiny
that's probably where
things
you
like,
have the most contact. So yeah, like, hit them with what you got.
And it's just, and this is exactly what you're saying is something I tell people like, are you angry at God? Yes, but I can't tell him that. Like, no. He knows. You have to
He
tell him.
already knows.
It's like
You're
you
not
have to
telling him
talk to him
anything
about this.
new.
You
I know.
have to talk to him about this. And they're like, well, he already knows. Why do I have to talk to him about it if he already knows? I'm like, one, because like if your spouse is mad at you and you know they're mad at you, do you still want them to talk to you about it? Yes. Okay, fine, great. Like same thing with God, where like you need it because it's cathartic. And two, he wants to talk to you about it. It's
But
exactly what
it's
you
more
said.
than that. It's more than that. It's he's not gonna take it from you unless you give it.
Well, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Well, because you're holding on to it. Because you're
Right,
holding on
right.
to it.
And he's
He
not
won't
gonna
take it
take it
from
from
you
you.
if you're holding on to it, he won't take
That's
it from
right.
you.
Not
Because you tell
anything, not even your
it's that
sins.
said it's the no right. It's the whole it's the great it's the best scene and the most memorable scene in The Great Divorce, if you've read that by C.S. Lewis.
I have not.
Okay, it's super worth reading, but it just very, very, very briefly, people who have read it, who are listening, are gonna be like, oh, I know what he's gonna talk about. But it's just like it's kind of a allegory of purgatory, but there's a scene where this character is like, there's this lizard on his shoulder that's got its claws in him, and it symbolizes his
I'm already
lust.
out.
Yeah, no. There's this lizard on the character's shoulder, and it symbolizes the character's lust. And the lizard like is telling this character like, you can't live without me, you need me. You can't live without me, you need me. And an angel of the Lord comes and asks the guy, do you want me to kill the lizard? And the guy's like, I don't know, like maybe like. And then like the angel's like, I will kill the lizard if you want me to kill the lizard. And the guy's like, ah. And then the lizard starts screaming, and it's like the lizard's like, no, don't let him take me. And like, you can't live without me. And like, and it's this really intense scene where like you have this nasty image of like this little like virile, nasty little lizard like telling this guy who its claws are in, like, you need me, you can't do anything without me. And an angel of the Lord who's like, I can kill it, but you need to tell me I have permission to kill it. And the guy, like, and the whole scene is the guy like going back and forth and
Going
like
back
trying
and
to figure out.
forth.
And it's a really beautiful, powerful reflection on exactly what you're saying, which is like, if I'm holding on to it, then he won't take it from me. He respects me too much for that. And so I think that this is one of the, but it's also the other thing you say, which is that like, so often we don't remember that the Lord is a person, right? And I think that when you start treating him like a person, all of a sudden your relationship with him really blossoms, because you're like, oh, I stopped treating him like an idea. I stopped treating him like a vending machine. I started treating him like a person. And all of a sudden, like, you realize he's been acting like a person this whole time. I just wasn't picking up on it. But like, as soon as I put on the, you know, my glasses that are faith, right? As soon as I really see things mm-hmm. through the lens of faith, I realize he's been acting like a person this whole
time. Yep.
And that's a key. That's the key thing. It's just, and it's not something he's hiding. It's just something we have to mature into. And that's just, you know, yeah. It's like everything else. He's not hiding it from, for like, look, the fact that little kids, you know, have pious prayers that are, and they're never angry at God and all this other, not never angry at God, but oftentimes, you know, not angry at God and about anything and just kind of, that's fine. That's a step.
Yeah.
That's a, it's step, a step. And that's fine. Like my dad,
the kids' prayers
my dad
are powerful.
Knew everything, right? Until, oh, that's, well, I think that's part of the reason why, right? It's like,
oh my gosh.
Because I think they just have such trust, because they have yeah. such trust.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but it's kind of similar, right, with us as kids. Like my dad knew everything until I was six. When I turned six, I realized there were certain things my dad didn't know, right? Like but you
and
think,
that day rocks your world.
It totally rocks your world. It totally
you're like,
rocks
wait
your
a
world,
minute.
Right?
Yeah.
But no, it's true. It's really, really true. That prayers, especially intercessory prayer. Let me just say something really, really quickly about intercessory prayer. For those who are suffering greatly, for those who are really, really suffering, their prayers and their intercession for other people is immensely powerful. A woman who I walked with for the past month and a half just died. Her funeral was yesterday. And she was a young woman. She was 48 years old and she died of cancer. And I was visiting her every week. And, you know, she and her husband got married a little bit later, but they have a little boy, they had one little boy. Mm. And so I'm visiting every week and seeing them. And at the funeral yesterday, and she was dying of cancer, and she was a very good woman, very faithful woman. And a woman at the funeral yesterday told me, she said, when she was dying, I asked her to pray for my nephew, who's a 7-year-old boy who has cancer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a 7-year-old boy who has cancer, who needs surgery, he's had treatments, and he's had one surgery to remove one tumor, and he needs surgery to go remove, you know, the remains of that tumor or the second tumor. So this woman asked the woman who I was taking care of, who was dying of cancer, please pray for my nephew. He's only 7 and he has cancer too. Please offer your sufferings up for him. And this woman said, I will. And she prayed for him. She prayed the rosary. And she offered her sufferings up for this little boy who has cancer. And then she died. Like within hours of doing that, she died.
Wow.
Two days later, the little boy went in for surgery. Tumor was gone. Intercessory prayer.
Holy jeez.
Intercessory
geez.
Prayer works. So you have, this just happened. Like this isn't, I'm just a parish priest in like a normal parish in, right, like there's,
yeah.
This is not some, like, I'm not, you know, like this woman who was suffering so much, she offered that suffering for somebody who had a similar suffering,
mm-hmm.
and that little boy was healed, right? This is
That's
astonishing,
amazing.
Right?
Yeah.
It's astonishing. So for those people who are really suffering, I submit that to them, that they're offering up of their sufferings and their intercessory prayers for people they know in their lives who are suffering. That is immensely powerful in the hands of our good God. So even in the midst of that great suffering, when it feels like your suffering is useless, we have God's assurance and we have evidence of that assurance that those things are not wasted, that those things are given, and great grace and healing can come about.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
we're not going to get better than that. So we're going to leave it there. And also,
okay.
My kids are trying to barrel down the door. So
okay.
Thank you so much, Father Clark. This is awesome. This
You're
is
very
awesome.
Welcome.
Also,
yeah, my joy.
I have to congratulate myself because I have been calling you Father Clark more
mm-hmm.
times than I have been just calling you Clark. So
That's
I'm
true.
Really proud of myself.
So, like,
I don't even want to know what it's like for your family, but I'm just really proud of myself that, like, I've made the adjustment.
Made the switch. Sweet.
All right.
Oh my gosh. This was awesome. Thanks so much, Emily.
Thanks for coming. Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. I hope it brightened your day and that you laughed as much as you learned. If you're enjoying the show and want more people to learn about what I share here, please leave a review and even share with a friend. I hope you'll join me again soon. Until then.